That was a portion of A Sound from Nicole Mitchell's new album Maroon Cloud, which features Aruan Ortiz on piano, Tamika Reed on cello, and Faye Victor on vocals. Nicole Mitchell is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and this is episode 23 of the Burning Ambulance podcast. If this is your first time listening, welcome, and if you've been with us for a while, welcome back. The Burning Ambulance podcast is part of the OSIRIS podcast network, which features over 24 shows on a wide variety of topics, from music to craft brewing to parenthood and many more. So visit OSIRISpod.com to check out all the programs and see if there are others that are of interest to you. OSIRIS is also a partner of Relics magazine, so visit Relics.com for music news and more. This show is available on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on other podcast aggregators, so please do subscribe and give us a star rating or a review on iTunes if you're so inclined. And if you really want to support us, you can visit patreon.com/burningambulance and make a donation to help keep the show rolling. Nicole Mitchell is a flutist and composer, originally from Syracuse, New York, but she grew up in California and eventually went to college in the Midwest, where she became an important figure on the Chicago jazz scene. In fact, she eventually became the first female president of the AACM there. Her primary group is called the Black Earth Ensemble. It has a fluctuating membership, but Tamika Reed is one of the core members. Tamika was featured on episode 7 of this podcast back in January. She spoke about working with Nicole and how important it was to her development as an artist, so now we're going to get the other side of the story. In addition to the Black Earth Ensemble, Mitchell has led a lot of one-off groups and been a part of other people's projects. She's in some of Anthony Braxton's large ensembles. She's been part of several of Rob Masaryk's groups, including the Exploding Star Orchestra and its offshoot projects. She's in the Indigo Trio with Harrison Bankhead and Hamid Drake. But she's really made a tremendous impact as a leader, creating music that covers a broad spectrum from jazz to modern composition to theatrical pieces and multimedia presentations, especially collaborating with and paying tribute to writers. As you'll hear in this conversation, texts are hugely important to her, even when the music itself is instrumental. Last year, her album Mandorla Awakening 2, Emerging Worlds, got a tremendous amount of critical acclaim. It combines violin, cello, guitar, and percussion with traditional Japanese instruments to create a sound that's both ancient and modern at once, and really is unlike anything else I've ever heard. So I'm going to play a section of Listening Embrace from that album, and then you'll hear my conversation with Nicole Mitchell. So you're originally from Syracuse, You grew up and studied music in California. So kind of take me through your early years musically, like when and how did you pick up the flute and what about it spoke to you?
It's interesting because living in Syracuse, I left there when I was 8, but I feel that I developed the ear for that instrument while I was there. I think from just relating to nature and birds. And when I heard the instrument for the first time, you know, I was in fourth grade or fifth grade, and I immediately resonated, you know, to the sound. And my parents were like, too bad. they weren't gonna allow me to play it. So I listened to it on the radio. I would tape it off the radio and I would pretend that I was playing it until I was in eighth grade. And then I finally found a way around their no and to turn it into a yes. But it was like 4 years of wanting to play it and not being allowed to play it.
Why was that? Why?
Because they had already bought me a viola.
Oh, okay.
You know, because, you know, they, with kids, I think they introduce you to strings first before they introduce you to the winds, because they think that it's easier to play or something. So they introduce you to strings earlier, and so I didn't know I had other options, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it was like, too bad.
Yeah, I remember. I think third or fourth grade, they tried me out on violin, and it just wasn't happening.
So I was really more attracted to the sound of the instrument than a certain kind of music or anything like that. I just wanted to play the instrument in whatever format that was accessible to me, which at that time was classical music.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another thing, you know. I guess people have these assumptions about instruments and how they're, where, what role they're supposed to play. So I didn't even get the opportunity to learn about improvisation until I went to college.
Do you think it's easy to establish your own voice on flute, since it is a relatively uncommon instrument in jazz still?
Well, the thing about the flute is there's a million flute players in the world playing classical, so the sound itself, you know, I think people kind of are a dime a dozen in just having a good sound on the instrument. So having your own voice on the instrument in that sense is not really too easy to do. In jazz, you know, things open up because not only there's not a lot of people playing it, but you know, you have a historical tradition of people using it as a second instrument or third instrument. So they're not really taking it that seriously, but I think that kind of makes it challenging to make that your main thing, because people are always looking, and what else do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's been way too many reviews of flute players that start out, well, the flute isn't really that well respected, but this person, they're doing something interesting. It's almost like the boilerplate introduction to, like, when people start talking about jazz flute.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just like any other instrument in terms of finding your own voice. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do, no matter what the instrument is. Because there's always, I mean, there's like definitely a million saxophone players, so that is obviously pretty hard. But then with the flute, it's like, if you're just doing something like it's been done before, people may not even listen to it, because there's already an assumption about the instrument that it's not interesting. So I think that's more of a hurdle, possibly, for flute players, or that's the first hurdle. Whereas people want to listen to a trumpet player, but then after they like, if you're good and you sound like somebody else, that's okay. And then they will see, okay, well, you have your own thing going or not, you know?
Yeah. Now, when you moved to Chicago, I read that you went there to study the house music scene.
That's right.
Academically. So what was that about? Was it more of a musical thing, or like a sociological analysis of the clubs, or what were you researching?
It definitely, the idea came from liking the music and wanting to, and also not seeing a lot written about it, and so like wanting to kind of get to how did it start, getting to the origins, but also the aesthetics, because people don't really realize that actually house music comes from a very specific culture, which is like, you know, it's African American, people know that, but if you get deeper into it, it's African American gay men culture, which is much more specific. And so I was really curious about that, and wanting to connect with people that were still the innovators, you know, there's some of them were still around, and nobody was really talking about it that much. So I was just really curious, and it gave me a chance also to learn more about the city, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as a young person, like, stuck in Oberlin, wanting to get back to Chicago, it was perfect.
Yeah.
It was a perfect way to get to Chicago for the summer. And then I never left.
Yeah, yeah. In what ways do you think your work embraces the social aspect of music? Because, I mean, you know, you're socially engaged, obviously, you know. But this music is created for a very small, self-selecting community. So whether that's deliberate or not.
Well, I guess I would disagree with you in a friendly way. because yes, playing for a Stone residency or something like that is, you know, you have a lot of people that are repeat audience members and, like, they're really into it and it's a small group of people. But, I mean, a lot of these musicians that play here or that play the kind of music that I'm playing, they're playing all over the world. And sometimes for audiences from, you know, maybe it could be 200, maybe it could be 1,000, and in some cases even over 5,000. Like, I've played in Millennium Park in Chicago, which has a 10,000 audience. I'm playing there in August, playing the Detroit Jazz Festival. You know, so it's not, and when we're making the music, we're not thinking about it in terms of only playing for this small group of people. I think if every musician, you would have to ask them individually mm-hmm. who their audience is, because I couldn't answer that. But I know for myself that, like, when I'm making music, like, especially, like, if you use example of Mandoral Awakening, I was thinking about everybody in terms of those that have been immersed in the Western way of living. That's who that piece was for, which is a lot of people, you know what I'm saying, in terms of asking that question about, you know, where do we go from here, because we're not doing things any better than we've been doing them for thousands of years, and we've been in denial, as you know, in terms of Western culture, this idea of advancement, you know, which is really not true on the humanistic level. It's only true on a technological level. But as people, as human beings, we're not any more egalitarian than we were thousands of years ago. And I would want as many people to hear that message as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using my own voice, like you talked about original voice, but I'm using my own voice to project that, which may limit my, you know, who gets to hear it or not. But my aesthetics are not, like, based on trying to entertain a certain specific audience. They're more internal in terms of what I feel connected to, you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? It's like I identify with the idea of contributing to contemporary African American culture, you know, and black experimentalism is something that I think is really important. I think that, like, radical imagination is something that's important. So I project that in order to encourage it, in order to, like, turn other people onto it. And, like, you know, the whole cookie cutter thing is, like, not really, you know, it's, like, not going to have people thinking or asking questions in the same way,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I know that's a long answer, but.
No, I mean, I'm just, you know, it basically ties into something that I've been thinking about for years, which is, you know, that obviously there's a subset of this sort of community, the what I refer to as the improv with a capital I people, you know, mm-hmm. and there's an attitude that's expressed sometimes that this sort of radical improvised music is innately or even morally superior to other forms of music, you know. And so
I definitely don't agree.
Yeah.
I don't think so. And then I do a lot of different things. I mean, collaborating with international musicians from other cultures, and, you know, like the project I have with Balaké Sissoko from Bamako, you know, from Mali, and or you know, or on the other end, I might, you know, do some duets with Joelle Leandre. You know what I mean? So, you know, there's a definitely a big spectrum there, but I don't, definitely don't play with a capital I, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Or I don't believe in that. Maybe, yeah. I mean, I'm sure somebody does, but not me.
Your first group, Samana, was an all-female ensemble, which was the first group like that in the history of the AACM.
Yeah.
So when you joined the AACM, did you feel immediately welcomed, or did you get the impression of sort of a boys' club atmosphere?
Well, actually, I was in the group before I was in the AACM. So the group started before, at the time, Maya, multi-instrumentalist, vocalist, she was the only member of the AACM when we first started the group. And so she brought both me and Shanta Narula into the group. And then at that point, the majority of the group was AACM members. So it definitely wasn't something in response to the AACM in terms of the male-female relations, because it was started independent of the AACM and then became officially, I guess, welcomed by the AACM as an official group over time, but originally it wasn't. So the other part of your question was about the, like, how hard was it being a woman in the AACM or something like that?
Not how hard was it, but just was it, you know, sort of like, I feel like, and this, you know, throughout history, a lot in the past, a lot of sort of revolutionary organizations have, in focusing on race or class issues, have allowed gender issues to take a back seat, or kind of said, you know, we'll ignore that entirely because we're working on this. And so I'm curious whether that has been your, you know, that was your experience there, or whether that's been your experience as an organizer and an activist generally.
I think there's a lot of issues that come up in any organization, and those are, I mean, gender issues come up, but also sometimes, especially when you have people that are very passionate and they've created something on their own and they put their whole life into it, you also have challenges with generational, you know, communication between, like, the founding generation and the younger generation, you know, because, you know, there's kind of a fear that maybe the younger people won't pass it on in the same way, or maybe they don't care about it as much and all that kind of thing. And so I feel that any of these organizations that have been around as long as AACM, those are some of the challenges you're going to deal with, and they definitely have been there. But I would also say that, again, it goes back to individuals, because I feel very lucky that even though I was coming in probably like third generation or something, that I had the opportunity to connect with some of the first generation members, like Mo Hall, Richard Abrams, you know, like Anthony Braxton, and Roscoe Mitchell, along with some of the more Chicago-centered first generation people like Douglas Ewart, you know, because there's like a wide span of perspectives and like how they view the organization, and also Amina Claudine Myers. So it really depends, like I said, back on the individual, because for me, there could be one dude like in the organization that's really like bullheaded and like you might consider sexist or whatever, but I know this is a collective and this person doesn't run stuff, you know what I mean? Like, I can go and talk to someone else, or I can go and have a great opportunity opened up, you know, with other members that are even more senior than that person is. So it's kind of, I guess, looking at structure, like the part of about it being a collective makes that, it makes it hard to institutionalize how the relations are going to be in that sense, I would say. And so you have the challenges you have in, like, on any kind of job or anything like that. But I wouldn't say that it was this idea like, oh, women need to take the back seat. I definitely, you know, looking at some of the other women and the things that they've done before. I mean, I was the only president, but in terms of musically feeling that they had the opportunity to find out what they wanted to do and be pushed to kind of, you know, go beyond their own boundaries and just design their own music and stuff like that. Everybody's pretty much in the same boat. But that said, people are always also going to choose who they want to play with. And so when you get to that dynamic, how often is a woman going to be chosen to be in this person's group or that person's group? That's not something, it's not governed mm-hmm. by the organization, so that stuff is going to happen, you know yeah. what I mean?
When you took over as president in 2009, what did you see as your responsibility to the organization and to the sort of the music scene in Chicago?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, people always ask me that, but I look at it a little different again because I think I became vice president in 2005. So from 2005 to 2010, I was in leadership either as vice president or co-president and then president. And it was all pretty much the same for me in terms of the work that I was doing. I mean, I guess partly because it is a collective, but I didn't feel that I had more power. I definitely didn't have more power. And I didn't necessarily have more goals either. I had just as many goals as a vice president. And in some ways, maybe like what you're saying about, you have those factors, the age factor and the gender factor. It was easier for me to implement ideas as a vice president than it was as a president. Because people would buy into the idea and they would take it as it's as their own, and then I could get stuff done without being like, well, what is this idea you have, you know? You know,
yeah,
but that's psychology.
let me ask you about your new record,
Marla. Oh, but I didn't say what the goals were.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
so. I'm gonna talk too much. So some of the things that I worked on were building partnerships, like partnership with Chicago State University, where we had the ACM school as a residency there, also with the Chicago Park District, partnerships with international jazz festivals, like the Bonnaroo Blues Festival in Paris, the Son de Vera Festival in Paris, the Insolite Jazz Festival in Pisa, Italy, and like creating concert series that were like multi-year concert series where ACM groups would be slated, planned to be slated on those festivals for a certain number of years and things like that. Bringing in new members, making sure that there was new members coming in, making sure that the new members were being orientated, you know, and also bridging the gap between the generations, because I'm kind of in this weird generation where there's not that many of us. There was like a whole bunch of people younger than me and a whole bunch of people older than me. And I could understand them all, but they didn't understand each other that well. So bridging that gap and also bridging the gap between the Chicago chapter and the New York chapter. That's a lot of the stuff that I was doing. Mm. And of course, raising money.
Yeah. So your new record, Maroon Cloud,
uh-huh.
It's a fairly high energy record, despite the fact that there's no traditional
drums.
Rhythm instrument. Yeah. So what's compositionally, what's the key to that energy in your mind?
Well, I always like the idea that the pulse is internalized. And so even when I work with drummers, like I don't want them to keep the time. Like, I don't want them to be responsible for that. I want them to be able to dance around it. And so hopefully the musicians that I work with, like, they get into that idea. So then without having the drums, we're able to maintain that spirit of momentum, and it really is about rhythmic tension. You know, a lot of times, you know, some of the music you listen to, it's like one rhythmic pattern that everything's sitting on, instead of like having like woven patterns that like fit together and like, and they can pull against each other. Like, they don't have to be exactly synchronized, because, you know, I was like, I don't know if you saw that film about Milford Graves that just came out.
I haven't seen it yet.
But it's really amazing. And he's talking about how people talk about how important it is to practice with the metronome, but you have your heartbeat, and it's like, that's the way life moves. I mean, all of us have hearts that fluctuate according to what's going on. It's not like this machine. You know what I mean? I mean, it is a machine, but it has flex, you know what I mean? So how did we decide that we want things so regimented, you know? And so that's something that I think is a lot of fun to do. And I like the challenge, but I also don't want people to listen to it and miss the drum. So like the layers and the flexibility of, you know, having different roles for the instrument, where maybe I'm playing an accompanying part versus like the solo part, you know, even though the assumption is I'm supposed to play this solo part. Mm-hmm. But what if the cello is playing the solo part, you know, and moving things around in that way. Moving parts and the interwoven rhythmic relationship, you know, creating a rhythmic tension that I think keeps the momentum going.
Do you have sort of broad, because that's a fairly broad, you know, sort of principle, compositional principle kind of. So are there other sort of big ideas that kind of guide all your music?
Well, it depends on what kind of music I'm writing. Because, like, for example, last night I did, like, flute and piano, music for flute and piano, and some of the pieces were totally through composed, and it's like, and then other pieces, like, incorporated improvisation, and then some of them were graphic scores where it's, like, a different kind of structure. So it really depends on which approach I decide to use it for that particular piece. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a lot of different approaches. If you listen to my music, you definitely will hear a lot of density most of the time. Like, I like things to be pretty dense. And, you know, with those layers, to have them moving around, sometimes independently of each other, you know. And rhythmically, I mean, there's definitely like an aesthetic with like African rhythms and things like that. Sometimes that might even be more than quote unquote jazz vernacular. And then, you know, color, like dealing with sound as color and energy. So it's just a few of those things.
And so you use sort of, you're not strictly a traditional notation kind of writer or a graphic scores person or guided improvisation. You kind of
use
whatever is, whatever works.
Whatever, yeah, that I decide to use at that time for that particular thing.
Texts are obviously very important to you. I mean, you've done multiple pieces that connect with the work of Octavia Butler, and Liberation Narratives obviously was a collaboration with Haki Madhubuti, and Maroon Cloud has Faye Victor, you know, so there's lyrics throughout most of it. What is the connection between words and music for you?
I think that keeps coming back to me. I guess I started writing words before I started playing music, and my mother was a self-taught fiction writer and poet, and almost every song that I've ever written has some kind of narrative backstory, even if the audience doesn't know what it is. Like, I'll use the narrative to write the music. So it's very much kind of at the core of my compositional practice, I would say. And It depends, like, you know, it definitely depends on what the project is, but there's a lot of pieces that are instrumental that have narratives that people don't necessarily know about. But I can tell you where this is happening and where that is happening, and you'll be like, oh, okay, like, you know, that makes sense, or I can hear that. I guess I'm very fascinated with the idea of music being powerful and, like, having an impact on us psychologically and physically, and, like, what kind of sounds can I make, certain sounds that make, that can induce certain feelings, and how do you reflect all the different things that nature can do in music? Like, how can you take the vast different expressions of the weather, for example, and be able to express that through sound, you know? And then in trying to do that, somehow I get caught up in narrative.
Yeah, because that almost goes back to, like, 18th and 19th century composers doing, you know, tone poems and stuff,
right,
where it would be like a piece called Traveling Down River or something, you know, and it's supposed to make you think of the landscape and stuff like that, you know. But, so there's always that kind of anchor.
Yeah,
even if it's not conveyed to the audience.
Yeah, and, you know, for a while I kind of was embarrassed by it because I feel like people feel like, well, that's some old stuff. I mean, that's programmatic music. We're past that now, you know. But then I was like, well, this is just, I just embraced it. Like, this is just who I am, and this is what kind of inspires me. So I just have to embrace it, even if it's old.
A lot of your albums are recorded live. Is that just a matter of economics? Like, because you're going to be performing the music, it's a good chance to capture it for future release? Or do you actually prefer that to a traditional studio setting?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that I definitely try my best to do a good recording if I'm doing a premiere. And sometimes I've been lucky that we have a good enough performance that I feel good about it and want to share it. It is very expensive to record. I do like recording, though. Like, for example, Xenogenesis, we did that in the studio. And I really, you know, when we have the opportunity to do that, I appreciate the sound that you can get in the studio. I mean, sometimes, you know, it can, you know, there's some magic that can happen when you have an audience that you can't really get in the studio. So if I can capture that sometimes, I like that as well. So it's kind of both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember reading that in the early 70s, Pharoah Sanders used to bring people to the studio to just kind of hang out while the band was playing.
Oh, have like probably seven made it sound
eight,
better.
Yeah, it would have like seven or eight, you know,
some
musicians
there
and then have people, you know, listening.
That's cool. I like that idea.
So I had Tamika Reed on this podcast before.
Okay, cool.
And she spoke about how important you were to her as like a mentor and someone who really kind of shoved her out into the world. So
I don't think she used that phrase, but
but how would you describe your kind of creative relationship? Because you two have been working together
for years now. You know, she's like my, you know, she's like, well, I don't know, I guess we're kind of almost a part of each other now, you know. It's like, I'm happy if she could do everything that I want to do, you know, but, you know, she's got her own stuff too. But yeah, she's a joy. I mean, she's a great inspiration, and she really inspired me from the moment I met her and heard her play. You know, even though she wasn't doing a lot of improvisation when I met her, but she always had an amazing sound, and I knew that she was really creative, you know, and you've seen like the results. She's, you know, she's like an international star, you know, and definitely has her own voice, and I feel that she's bringing the cello into new realms, because it's also another instrument not taken very seriously in jazz. So we have that in common too. But yeah, I mean, she's a huge inspiration, and you know, I totally trust her to do anything, and you know, hopefully she feels the same about me.
The first couple of Black Earth Ensemble records were recorded at multiple sessions with multiple lineups. So was the group kind of still coming together conceptually while you were...
Well, the thing is, Black Earth was, from the very beginning, an ensemble that has shifting instrumentation and personnel. Every single gig we played, it was going to be a little bit different in terms of what the instruments are, who's playing, how many people are playing. You know, that was always that way from the beginning. So I think Vision Quest was the first record, and I had that a session. I think it was Economics. I had a session that we did, but somehow the drums weren't recorded properly, and so we couldn't use some of the tracks, and then I had to go back in the studio, and then so-and-so wasn't available, or so, you know, so it was like, it was more that kind of situation of piecemealing the money and like not the greatest recording situations. Like Africa Rising was recorded at the Hot House. I mean, it wasn't in, I mean, the main part of it was done like literally in a club, but when the club was closed because we didn't have a studio big enough to have the whole group in there. And it had wood floors, it was a really nice space. Marguerite Horberg like helped us to do that, but then we recorded that, but then we couldn't get the space again. You know what I mean? So it was like, we got Africa Rising, the actual piece, that recorded, but then there was still all these other songs I needed to record. I couldn't get back into that place, so then we had to go to another place, and who was available for this, and, you know. So that was really, you know, when you talk about starting out and struggling and not having money and just trying to, like, do some ambitious project, and how do you make it work, you know?
Yeah. And has your sort of overarching vision for the project and for the ensemble, has it stayed the same, or has it changed over time? Like, what you see Black Earth, you know, what is it to you, and how has it, you know, what purpose it serves in your...
We've stayed on our mission pretty good. I mean, that there, you know, there's a lot of like concepts that come from the original idea of Black Earth Ensemble. I mean, the first one is that it be a platform for my creative vision, you know, because I had played with a lot of other groups as a side person, and I started bringing in compositions. They're like, nope, start your own group. You know, and so when I did, I mean, I was like, okay, well, this is going to be for my vision, but it was, when I said creative vision, I saw that it might be more than music. And we have done some multi-arts projects or interdisciplinary projects. I mean, Mandoral Awakening had video, Vision Quest, Hope Future Destiny, which is like the third album, was a play. It was like a community play, had like over 40 community members involved, but also had like, you know, professional dancers, and then Black Earth Ensemble, and a video artist, and, you know, so that part has stayed true to the mission in terms of, you know, being really flexible, like I said, across that spectrum of, you know, some of the stuff being more, maybe some people consider traditional jazz, some stuff being like way out there and super experimental, and then international collaborations like with Bamako Chicago or even with Mandoral Awakening. So that part I think is stuck true. Also the idea of honoring Mother Earth, like, so Black Earth meaning that the soil is black, that means that it's rich and it's fertile and that like things can grow from it, and that we don't, it, so in the sense of that, the gender equity has always been there, you know, it's always been multi-generational, you know, it's always been like a celebration of African-American culture and also of diversity, like, you know, you have a diverse, you know, number of musicians that are in the group, and so all those things have pretty much been consistent, and we're 20 years old now.
So how did you connect with Rob Masaryk and join the Exploding Star Orchestra? What
he asked me to do a project in 2005. So that was the first, like, I guess it was like, I think that was when he started using that name, Exploding Star. It was like a project for City of Chicago, I think for Millennium Park, and he invited like a large number of musicians from across the Chicago scene, including myself, and it was great because it was other musicians that I had known and I had heard but I'd never played with, and some of them didn't even ever speak to me before until we played on that project. I'm like, yeah, I used to say hi to you and you never even would look at me, and now we're, you know, oh no, I, you know, I didn't mean anything, okay. You know, so it was cool, like, to bring people together for Rob's project, and he's been able to keep that going for some years now. I mean, 2005, this is 2018, and you know, we're doing a project in Berlin in September.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The record you did with Bill Dixon, was that your first encounter with him?
Oh yeah. It was awesome.
Did you, what did you take away from working with him that applied to your own work later or anything like that?
Oh, that's a great question. Sound. He gave me a whole nother level of, I guess, inquisitiveness about what are the possibilities with sound. I mean, one thing that he was very adamant about was not using vibrato. And so, and he was very focused on every individual in the group and what was their sound and like how developed their sound was or not, you know, and it just kind of gave me another level of awareness about that. I know it sounds very general, but it's hard to put in words. But just, I mean, there's a lot there. Like, when you get into just playing one note for a really long time, and the type of overtones that will change when you change the dynamic level, you know, just playing that one note. And then you have different instruments playing it together, then the texture and the overtones are changing depending on who's playing louder or not, or, you know, it's like, there's a lot there that we take for granted. Mm-hmm. You know, and people are so focused on style that sometimes they forget that it really starts with the actual sound. I mean, the thing, you know, people talk about Miles or Coltrane, it's like the sound of their instrument. They could be playing one note. You know it's them, and there's something you're getting from that, you know, just from that one note. And I think people take that for granted a lot. And actually, from my own journey, when I started playing flute, I was really frustrated with my sound, and I heard a sound that I had wasn't able to make, and I would spend literally 12 hours a day playing, practicing, and I would spend, you know, 2 or 3 hours playing one note, trying to get it the way I wanted it to sound, you know, and that was really probably the most intense period of my practicing, you know. But it, again, it was about that. And, you know, I think Bill was a master of that.
Yeah, yeah. I spoke to him years ago, and he said that, you know, when he was running student orchestras at, you know, where he was teaching, he said if he had somebody that could only play one note on an instrument, he says, I can find a use for that one note. You know, you can find a spot in the organization for somebody who will do that one thing, you know, and just point at them and they
it's
do their
your
thing.
Turn.
And yeah,
do
your thing.
That's cool.
You did a Black Earth live CD and DVD on Delmark.
Yeah.
And the track listings between the audio and video versions are very different.
You mean in terms of the takes? Or
I guess. Well, I'm not sure, because I look at the CD and it's a completely different track listing than the DVD.
Oh, you mean the order?
Yeah. So did you just kind of shuffle the tracks
around?
Yeah,
I think that, well, of course, the live show stayed in the order of the actual show.
Mm-hmm.
But the CD was literally recorded in the studio. So they're not the same recording. And then I guess the way I heard, you know, some songs might be longer than they would have been in the on the live concert or something, or shorter. And so I changed the order to what felt natural to me.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because I feel like the CD was actually labeled as being a live recording. So I don't, that was why I was kind of thrown off by that. But maybe that was Delmar's fault.
I do remember recording some of it in the studio.
Yeah. And then Black Earth Strings, what was that, like 2009 or so?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was more of like a chamber group than Black Earth yeah. Ensemble. So how did the one evolve out of the other?
Well, if you look at my first CD, Vision Quest, it really was Black Earth Strings in a sense, because it was like, you know, I had two violinists and I really liked that sound. And I was actually, in this sense, this is like what happens when you're first starting out, I was a little bit frustrated when I put the CD out and people didn't know how to categorize it. They're like, is this jazz? Is this what? You know, I was like, oh, it's because the instruments. Because I play the flute already. And then I got some violins. And they're like, what? What do we do? You know, so I already was working with saxophone, you know, with David Boykin at the time, and different trumpet players, you know, at different times. And so I consciously was like, okay, well, my next album is going to be a different instrumentation, because I'm curious how people respond to that. And then, you know, now all of a sudden it's jazz because there's a saxophone and a trumpet, which is kind of sad, but is it true?
Uh-huh.
It's like now all of a sudden, okay, I'm still writing the music, but now it's jazz. Okay, okay, fine. But then I wanted to keep the string group going, and I really liked the freedom of not playing amplified, you know, of just like playing and not having to be mic'd. And, you know, so that group, you know, we played a lot, but we just didn't, we only made one record. And we actually, it's funny, you know, some projects are like sleepers, like you make the project and you don't necessarily get some big tour from it or something, but it was a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, you mentioned David Boykin. I was curious about the records that you made as part of his group, like where you see those as part of your sort of overall creative journey.
Working with him was a really important chapter in my creative journey, because he was the first band leader that was welcoming me to be a side person. Because the thing is, if you think about it, who wants a flute player? So when I'm starting out, I'm asking to play with people, I'm trying to get opportunities to learn, and nobody wants to hire me. You know what I mean? And I'm sure it didn't help that I was a woman too, like a flute player and a woman. No, that we don't need that.
Yeah,
you know,
she's gonna wanna sing.
There's plenty of saxophone players that can play a little flute. You know, I mean, Ari Brown in Chicago plays flute, you know, so wouldn't you rather hire Ari Brown? Like, what do you need me for, you know? So, but that helped me to become a band leader, because I needed to create opportunities for myself to develop. But David Boykin was the first person that was like, yeah, I want you to play. And he also was the first person to say, don't people tell you that they're scared of you? I'm like, what? What are you talking about? He's like, you're intimidating. Intimidating? How am I intimidating? But nobody ever said that before, you know. And in Samana, the running rule was you should be able to fulfill your whole musical experience in Samana. There should be no reason for you to be in another group. So I actually did that for 7 years, which, you know, I was young and I didn't really think about it that much. I just rolled with that code without critiquing it too much, but when I think about it now, I'm like, wow, what else could I have been doing, you know, and where would I be now? Or, you know, I think it was good for me though, because I didn't have a lot of confidence, so it helped me to have an incubation period. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, playing with the Expanse was really important. It was challenging. The music was really, you know, exciting and, you know, and difficult. And yeah, so we were playing every month at the Velvet, and that definitely helped me to evolve and to like prepare for being a band leader, you know.
And you two also had a label.
Yeah. Yeah. But we had Dreamtime Records.
Are those records still in print? Are you still sort of running that
operation?
I mean, no.
No, the record label doesn't exist anymore. But, you know, I'm sure he has some copies of his records, and I still have a few copies of my records. And, you know, I sell the digital copies online. It's on iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Awakening album that you did in 2011.
Oh, yeah, that was kind of a one-off, huh?
Yeah, it was the only album that I saw that was billed to you rather than Black Earth.
Right.
So what was I trying to do there? Yeah, what was the idea?
I guess I'm always, like, trying to do different things, and that could have easily been Black Earth Quartet or something, but I guess I was just curious about doing it differently. I think, I'm not sure if it was right after, well, I mean, before that I was playing in Frequency though, I mean, with Ed Wilkerson and Ariel Ra and Harrison Bankhead. So Frequency existed before that Awakening album, and that wasn't Black Earth, and it wasn't my group, it was an improvised group, a collective.
Yeah.
And also Indigo Trio with Harrison Bankhead and Jaime Drake. And that's also a collective. And those things existed before I did that album.
But when you make a record under your own name, like, publicists and marketing people perk their heads up, you know, because they're like, okay, now we can sell you in this way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I was just curious about, I guess I'm like, I call it like a spherical approach where you try something one way and then you like even when I compose, like I might write a song singing, then the next song I write using my flute, then the next one I'm using the piano, then the next one I'm just writing directly on the paper with nothing, you know, or it might be a graphic score here one day and then, you know, like writing all out, you know, through compose the next day. So it's kind of, I just, maybe it's the Aquarian in me always trying to do stuff different. Yeah. Because then I also did Sonic Projections with Chad Taylor and Craig Taborn and David Boykin, and that was under a different name. And then Ice Crystals,
mm-hmm.
which is also one CD.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, we played that music for years. It's kind of weird. Sometimes you like play for years as a group without making a record, then you make the record, and it kind of like concludes the whole process for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, yeah. The use of the Japanese instruments on Mandorla Awakening, uh-huh. I thought was really interesting, because when I was listening to it, and you know, to write about it, it gave it more of an ancient than a futuristic quality to me.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of balance
That's
were you
good.
Trying to strike between sort of musical traditions and also kind of between past and future?
That's
know?
Great. I'm glad you felt that, because that's what I was shooting for. I was dealing with this idea of colliding duality. So I wanted to collide vulnerable with, you know, super powerful, you know, like you got these superpower, you know, when I say superpower, like I think about like, you know, these first world nations that are just like got nuclear bombs and, you know, it's like you've got that. And then you got people living in a village that, you know, it's like they're just really living off the land, you know, they're they're already found a way to be sustainable with their lives, you know, and with, you know, cooperating with the environment. They're not bothering anybody, but it's like, those are two very extreme differences. And how do you collide those things together in terms of bringing the wisdom of those people that are living on the land and have been doing that for a very long time? And then we have all this technology, but have lost a lot of common sense in terms of how to even survive, because we don't know how to build a house. We don't know how to, you know, we don't know how to, and a lot of people don't know how to grow food or take care of themselves if there's a disaster. You know, how do you bring those wisdoms together and like overlap them? Which, you know, those two overlapping circles actually creates the shape of the mandorla, which is where the name comes from. So I'm colliding country versus urban. You know, you've got the rock with the guitar, the rock sound, but then you also have the classical sounds over the sound, you know, kind of more vulnerable acoustic versus electric. And, you know, and then you have all these different musical languages that are colliding too. You know, you have this traditional Japanese shakuhachi and taiko drum and shamisen, but then you also have you know, you have Avery who's bringing in the black church, and then you have you know, you have some jazz elements, you know. So all these things are really kind of basically modeling another way of coexistence. Like, how can you maintain your authentic voice and coexist with others versus like, why does somebody have to dominate somebody else? Like, why does this voice, you know, when you think about like free improv, it's like everybody takes on the classical new music sounds, and like that's the language that they can share to create together. But is that really non-definitive, or does that have an identity? Which I would say it has, like that identity of classical new music, like from the European new music tradition. Mm-hmm. So how do you like bring all that stuff together? That's what I was trying to do.
Piece. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of this famous quote from William Gibson, where he says, you know, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. And so, you know, there's always people that have all the technology and they coexist with people who have none of it, you know?
And so this idea of utopia is like leaving or escaping all the damage and chaos. It's like, we can't really do that, you know? So how do you embrace the chaos, you know? And isn't that futuristic, like, because that's really what we're dealing, that's what we're dealing with, you know? And so ancient and future mixed together, you know, I guess people will call that, some people call it, instead of calling it Afrofuturism, they call it Afro-surrealism. But it's just, it's fascinating to me, and I feel like I barely touched the surface with the possibility of trying to express that musically.
How did you come into Anthony Braxton's orbit and sort of start participating in, because you're in some of his large ensembles, like 10, 12 musicians.
I actually have no idea how that came about. All I know is I got a email from Taylor O'Bynum one day who said, you've been drafted. No. Yeah, I'm thankful for that. I mean, I've learned a lot from Braxton. Yeah.
And what, like?
I mean, he, this thing that I'm talking about, like the coexistence of different musical languages, he's been doing that for a really long time. He really has found a way to like have large ensembles that are non-hierarchical, you know what I mean? And where you have leadership that can pop up in any place, in any part of the ensemble at any time. You know, he's been developing that for years, and he's always had, you know, gender balance with his groups, and, you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, he's really trailblazed a lot of these concepts.
Yeah. I guess my last question is, beyond your work as a teacher, you know, you seem to have a strong inclination toward mentorship in general. Do you feel like it's a musician's responsibility to pass knowledge to the next generation of players, you know?
I think that intuitively everyone, it would make sense for everyone to naturally just do that. I mean, because, I mean, we're a little bit confused and distracted by the academic structure that now, like with improvised music, with jazz, creative music, you know, we have people going through this system, this academic system, in order to develop as a musician. But like, that's not where the music comes from. That's not where this music comes from. And it's important to be grounded in the truth of where the music comes from, you know. And that music did not come from academia. That's not where it's from. That's not the origin. And that's not where the spirit will ever be, you know. And so when you get real with that, that this music is about the people, and it's about resistance, and it's about community, then you would intuitively want to just keep sharing it and passing it down to younger people and to new people that are interested in it. Because it may be someone who's coming from another experience. Maybe they're not quote unquote younger. Maybe they've been doing, you know, many years doing something else, but they already are ready now to do this, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think we just have to get more in tune with that, and it'll help us to stay grounded and allow the music to continue, you know, in a positive and powerful direction, you know?
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem, I think, is that the Miles Davis, Art Blakey model is sort of gone, you know, in the sense of like older dudes bringing in young people to be in
but
the
band. But it's not, because you just said I do that.
Yeah, well, you do. But
and there's,
I feel like
there's other people that do that too.
I feel like it's more common maybe in Chicago. Like there's more of a community spirit in Chicago
than
there is in New York.
I mean, I'm doing a concert
in New York
here tomorrow night with some younger musicians.
Oh yeah?
In New York. People get around. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's a, you know, it's finding a way to make it financially viable also, you know.
What do you mean?
I mean, finding a way to, you know, to make it pay to be able to, you know, get musicians and work enough with them that you're passing something significant on to them, you know. Because I feel like there's maybe...
You mean because they can go to school and pay to go to school?
No, I mean because... No, I'm talking
about
out of school.
And I'm
not
saying
people
shouldn't go to school. I
right.
just think that people in school need to remember who they are.
Mm-hmm.
While they're in school, I mean, school is an amazing resource. And a lot of times people don't even take advantage of the resources while they have them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that's like a multi-million dollar corporation that is there to serve what you want to do. And if you remember that you're an artist and you remember like this is a certain period of time that I have these resources and how can I use these resources to connect with the community, you know what I mean? And that's the, I mean, you're talking about money, I mean, that's, it's there, it's just not being utilized as well as it could be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I
yeah.
mean, every student in a school, in an institution, has the ability or possibility to do some really meaningful work and learn a lot, you know, and really develop like to a fuller potential by connecting with the community and by utilizing those resources, you know, and it, everybody benefits, but people just aren't looking at it like that.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I'm thinking more, and this kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, is outside of, you know, the school environment, like, is there a way to assemble a band of 20-year-olds, take them on the road, and show them how to become professional musicians or whatever? You know, I feel like that doesn't necessarily exist.
Well,
it doesn't
happen in mass. It happens every day. Like, for example, Joshua White is a great young pianist in LA, and, you know, he was only playing in San Diego, but then he started playing with Mark Dresser, who's in San Diego, and then somehow Mark Dresser's relationship with Rude Resch, like, Joshua, like, somehow is now playing with Rude Resch, and he went on, you know, European tour with Rude Resch. So it's like, that stuff happens, but it's not going to be like five people in, you know, with an elder or something like that. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's like one person, you know, developing a one relationship at a time. But I feel that a lot of young people aren't even seeking mentors, you know, so it's like you're not going to just pursue a younger person. I mean, that's kind of like creepy, like, you know what I'm saying? But it's like, you know, it's like the younger people have to seek out mentorship, and then, you know, and you have this, but that's, I mean, then that whole circle, I know you were trying to end, but like, then that raises a question about the real gender challenges, you know, because for a young woman, I mean, for me, it wasn't the easiest thing, and it isn't the easiest thing even now, generations later, for like a younger woman to like try to find mentorship when it's like, you know, usually it's going to be an older male, and how do you like have a professional mentorship relationship like without there being some problem, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And you know that now that's like something that I didn't have. I mean, for the most part, I definitely didn't have any problems in the ACM with that. And in jazz, I had a few problems, like in other, you know, realms outside of the ACM, but not to the seriousness of what some of these other women are talking about. But then there was plenty of situations that I walked away before that could happen,
mm-hmm.
you know. So the training and also the... You know, the more that women like me, I guess, have opportunities to develop, then that opens up more opportunities for women after me as well. So.
Because
I think Tamika talked about, like, she had me and she also had Dee Alexander. So she had women mentors, you know what I mean? But there's a lot of young women that haven't had that opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. What I think is also interesting is there are women who have spoken in interviews, like Terry Lynn Carrington has talked about teaching young male students and having them be kind of shocked that an older woman would have anything to teach them.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
That's nothing new.
So I feel like that could be, in its own way, that could be just as important as having, you know,
oh,
a
it's
generation
definitely,
of
it's
female
definitely,
professionals.
Yeah, it's you know? Definitely important that the males have that experience of having a woman teacher. Definitely.
Okay, that was my interview with Nicole Mitchell, and that concludes this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS Podcast Network. Visit osirispod.com to check out their other shows, and check out relics.com for music news and other stuff. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll come back for the next one. OSIRIS.